are listening to a free version of the Majority Report with Sam Steeter. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeter.
The destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Steeter.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeter.
Ever get the feeling you've been cheated?
It is Wednesday, August 20th, 2014. My name is Sam Steeter. This is the three-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. Today on the program, the chair of Center of African American Studies at Princeton University, Professor Eddie Gloud, on Ferguson and race and neoliberalism and America. Also on the program, reports of what has happened to at least some of the children we have sent back to Honduras, those who were seeking refuge in this country. Reports out and a video purportedly showing independent war correspondent James Foley being beheaded by ISIS forces in Syria. Huge percentage of our vets now living in poverty, needing food assistance. Rick Perry poses for a self-portrait at the Travis County Sheriff's Office, otherwise known as a mugshot. Booked. And I look back on that horrible train explosion of Bakken crude in Quebec. And a report now shows that that train, which killed, I believe, about 40 people, spent most of its time in the United States. All that and more on today's program. We are back, folks, from vacation, and it's been just vacation was nice, and I know all three of us here tried to do our best to avoid the news, but what happened in Ferguson over the past couple of weeks has been just shocking and unbelievable. We also, the truce has ended in the latest war between Israel and, well, I guess Hamas, and just a tough couple weeks of news to deal with. But we're going to talk to Professor Eddie Gloud, one of my favorite guests over the years. And I had spoken to him on the Ring of Fire daily show, just touching on the anniversary of the Civil Rights Act, I guess the 50-year, I should say, anniversary of the Civil Rights Act a couple of weeks ago, and wanted to continue our conversation then, and this seems to be sadly an appropriate time to do that. Just a reminder, folks, and hopefully I was able to catch up on all the emails over vacation. But it is your memberships that keep this show alive. And we've had a lot of people who are still going through some very difficult financial times. And if you are not one of those people but enjoy the show and have the means to support it, I hope you will. And as a bonus, we give you an extra 50 minutes of material a day. So head over to majority.fm, become a member. Don't forget, if you buy crap from Amazon, buy it through our Amazon link at majorityreportkickback.com. We'll take a quick break, and when we come back, we'll be talking to Professor Eddie Gloud. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It is a pleasure to welcome to the program the chair of the Center of African American Studies at Princeton University and author of the forthcoming Democracy in Black, How Race Still Governs the Soul of America. I guess that's coming out in 2015. Professor Eddie Gloud, thanks so much for joining us today.
It's always a pleasure to talk with you, Sam.
Now, we spoke, I guess it was about a month ago or so, on the 50th anniversary of the Civil Rights Act, and we started to talk about a lot of issues, I think, that really are in play with what has happened in Ferguson, and there are so many issues involved in what we've seen. Starting with the shooting of Michael Brown, and then with the police response, and frankly the political response. Just give me your thoughts up front of what we've seen there.
Well, I mean, it's been an unmitigated disaster on every level. And I think it's important, Sam, to just make explicit what I think is underneath what has happened in Ferguson and what has been happening throughout the country. And that is, in the United States, contrary to our stated principles, there is an operating and ongoing practice in which certain people's lives are valued more than others. And when I say certain people's lives, I'm being a bit generous here. It is the case that if you're white, if you're rich, and if you're male, your life, and if you're straight, your life is valued more than others who are not. And we see that in the way in which communities are policed, and we see that specifically in Ferguson. When you talk about what the town of 21,000 people, 67% are black, one out of four who live in Ferguson live below the federal poverty level, which means that they make less than $24,000 a year. And you see that the consistent experience of a community that is over-policed, that is constantly under surveillance, and don't feel a sense of protection. So there's economic vulnerability. There's a sense of being occupied by a police force that doesn't represent them in terms of the idea of serving and protecting the community. There's a lack of representation in city governance. And so what you have is a population that is, for the most part, marginalized from the daily operations of democratic life in this country, a population many of whom lack the resources to imagine a good life for themselves and for their children. And so when you have the tragedy of Michael Brown, the obvious murder of Michael Brown, no wonder we are experiencing what we're experiencing in Ferguson.
I mean, it's been frustrating to me on some level to watch, you know, the the reporting and the coverage of this, because on some level there's an element of, I don't know. I mean, I guess someone has called it conflict porn. And that's an element of it. And then there's also the sort of the obsessive parsing of what will happen legally to this cop who, you know, I think by the opinion of many people I've read and talked to seem to think that, you know, very hard to be able to prosecute a cop in this situation because they have basically because of this dynamic, I guess, that exists. And very little talk and discussion about that aspect of just of this being an ongoing problem, that that what has happened with Michael Brown was a is really sort of the tip of the iceberg in some way, just peering out of the water. And there's really not been a national attempt to look below the surface.
Right, right. And, you know, I mean, I think Bob Herbert has a piece now out in Demos where he talks about the theater around these sorts of events, and nothing changes, nothing happens. He was talking about, you know, the surprise that America expresses, that white America expresses when they're confronted with what, for all intents and purposes, is the horror of living particular kinds of lives in particular sorts of places. And he invokes Katrina, you know, oh my God, you know, Katrina literally washes up into the, in, you know, into the sight of the broader country or the nation, what people are living daily, right? And we're going, that can't happen in America, right? And so here we are, again with Ferguson, and people are asking the question, how can this happen in America when in fact it's happening day in and day out? Right, it's happening every single day. I mean, if we were to go down the line, I mean, just in this month alone, Sam, how many people have been killed by the police? Eric Garner, Ezell Ford. I mean, we could just Michael Brown. I mean, we can just keep going, right? And then, of course, there's Kendrick Johnson, there's Renisha McBride, there's Jonathan Farrell, there's Jordan Davis, there's Trayvon Martin, there's Marlene Pinnock, who was just brutally beaten by a California Highway Patrol person. So people are surprised, and then we have the conflict porn, as you so powerfully put it. Then you have the entertainment corporate media driving this, and no one is really looking at the root causes. And the root causes is that there's a congenital disease that distorts this country, and that congenital disease is white supremacy.
Yeah,
Go ahead.
No, I wanted to actually talk about that because, you know, when we spoke on the anniversary of the Civil Rights Act, it is something that when you talk about white supremacy being a through line through our politics from really in the founding of this country, and it was a little bit revelatory for me because on some level I think. I have always perceived this issue of race as being specific to non-whites, as opposed to seeing it from the perspective of it really is ultimately about providing supremacy for a very specific and, you know, and I think one could argue historically white male supremacy. And if you perceive it through that lens, things make a lot more sense as the way to break things down, I guess.
It's hard for people to hear the phrase white supremacy and not think of people running around in hoods, white hoods, and burning crosses in yards, or, you know, putting up Nazi, you know, swastikas or the like. But white supremacy is really about the belief and the practice that white people ought to be valued more than non-white people. And it's not just simply, and we tend to think about that as holding a racist belief, when in fact it can be evidenced in the very social arrangements that organize our lives. So who has access to the best schools? Who has access to inherited wealth? Who has access to the best jobs? Who has, and you know, and we have to understand as well, Brother Sam, is that white supremacy is not just simply the ideology of white people, right? It's a practice that I can participate in, that President Obama can be the head of, you know, can participate in. And so part of, you know, and in the background that's in my head is, you know, this wonderful moment in James Baldwin's The Fire Next Time where he says, as long as we've been, I'm paraphrasing here, as long as we believe we're a white nation in the vein of Europe, we will never achieve our country. And so part of, you know, part of the challenge is that, you know, I mean, just to really quickly, another study says that, you know, people believe that, you know, racial equality is a zero-sum game, that as black folk gain more access to American life, many white respondents believe that they lose, right, benefits and resources. So when you have this view of racial equality as a zero-sum game, then we understand what the stakes are. Right, we understand what the stakes are, and now we have this wonderful, wonderfully efficient ideological frame to blame the very people who are locked out and marginalized for their own marginalization. Right, so you know, let's make Michael Brown a thug, let's make him a criminal, let's give an account of the culture of poverty that has produced these people who don't warrant the kind of respect and dignity that we would accord to others. If that makes sense to you.
Yes, I mean, there's two things I want to touch on there, but this notion of white supremacy being a practice, and at one point, I guess Nelly had spoken about and engaged in what one writer, and I cannot remember, but the politics of respectability.
Right.
And this notion, and we have seen a lot about this, and we spoke about this briefly and didn't get into it, but the making sort of poverty a pathology. We see this practice adopted on some level, not just by the Paul Ryans out there, but on some level also by President Obama. I mean, talk about draw this out for us, this notion of it being a practice, the politics of respectability, which is sort of the mirror image of that practice of white supremacy.
Right. So when we talk about white supremacy as a practice, what we're talking about is the very ways in which our social arrangements, right, orient us to one another in such a way that the basic claim that some people are valued more than others are lived out in our choices. Now, that's kind of abstract, but let's kind of make it concrete. So there's a way in which most states fund schools, right, by local neighborhoods. Right. I mean, so we know how schools are funded, right, through property taxes. But we know that residential segregation, right, is thick, right, in the United States. And there was a deliberate effort to undermine efforts at coming out of the 1960s to really desegregate housing in the United States and neighborhoods. And so even though schools are funded by way of property taxes, and even though we know that residential segregation is rampant in the United States, we still are comfortable with making the choice that some people can go to bad schools and some people can't go to bad schools. Now, some people can go to good schools. And that you don't have to be Bull Connor, right, to hold that view. You can just say, I want my kid to go to the best schools, right? And holding that view, you still perpetuate, right, the inequality that is rampant in the country. Now, at the same time that those choices are being made, right, I just want my kid to go to the best school, we need to live in a safe neighborhood, which means we leave these other people living in less than safe neighborhoods and going to bad schools, right, we can then say those people who attend those bad schools and those people who live in those bad neighborhoods live in those circumstances because of their behavior. It's not because of any choices that I'm making. I'm not deliberately racist, right? It's because their behavior is such that they don't exhibit, right, the wherewithal, the individual motivation to make themselves better. They just want government handouts. They're welfare babe, you know, welfare women and mothers, right? Their children are undisciplined, and Obama will say they're feeding them Popeyes for breakfast, with no mention of the fact that they're food deserts, right? Or they're not really performing in school with no real mention that there are 40 people in the classroom with an untrained teacher in front of them. So part of what we're saying is that when we think about white supremacy as a practice, we're not talking about people running around calling people the N-word or burning crosses. We're talking about the very way in which our society is organized, which reproduces benefits for particular people, right, and marginalizes others, right, because of just simply where they were born and the color of their skin. And then you have folks like me and folks like Obama, Brother Sam, who we can gain access to mainstream American life, right? And then we become the billboard for the inclusion, the inclusiveness of American life, when in fact we're as stratified and segregated as we've ever been. Does that make sense?
Yes, and also, I mean, just it, generally speaking, for and I think, you know, this has been argued, you know, I think in both a critical and supportive way of President Obama, at least, that he has either as an individual or as the president has an inability to do anything other than to accept that practice on some level. You know, some time ago, I spoke to Randall Kennedy, and he wrote the persistence of the color line, and I think that was sort of his argument on some level that, and in fact, I saw a piece as to why President Obama, when he addressed what was going on in Ferguson, was never going to please, you know, his supporters, I guess, or people who had anticipated more from him, I mean, break that down for us a little bit, because, you know, the argument I saw, for instance, by Ezra Klein was that, well, the White House knows at this point that anything they come out for actually creates more polarization. And so he just thought it was best for him to sit on the sidelines. Give me your take on that.
But, you know, Sam, that's so powerful in what it reveals. Right? I mean, to make that claim, for Klein to make that claim, or for Randy to make that claim, we're basically saying, without saying it explicitly, that we're a deeply racist society. And so to the extent to which Obama or any of us speak directly, right, to racial disparity, to the fact that this police officer shot an 18-year-old kid, killed him, used deadly force, unarmed, right, the fact that we want to call attention to the racial dimensions, right, of the militarization of policing in this country would generate and activate, right, a kind of white backlash, would activate white fears, right, and it would polarize us even more. That's just a nice way of saying if Obama says this, it will give license to people to express racist views. So then the remedy to that is to not say anything directly about it, which in the end achieves what? It leaves all of it in place.
Right.
So it's a deadly circuit and cycle. And I've made the claim that if we continue to dance the dance of white supremacy, it will always continue to organize our lives. If I'm worried about activating the fear of my white interlocutor, right, and that leads me to repress, right, the very nature of the kind of hell that I'm catching, then I leave in place the conditions for the hell. And this is what infuriates me with Obama. He refuses to change the frame. And then the excuse, right, is that he cannot do otherwise. Right? He cannot be otherwise. And that, to me, is a fatalist position which suggests that America will always be this kind of place.
Right. And it basically says that you really need a white guy if anybody can raise this type of issue. But even then, right, the argument remains the same. I mean, at one point, it has to be addressed. I mean, you know, to me, one of the most sort of shocking things about the aftermath of this, I mean, there's two things that have stayed. One is the idea that a police force could go into an 80% white neighborhood or town in the country, 70%, 60% white neighborhood even, dressed like that with that type of gear. And then on top of it, and for some reason, this just sort of just sticks out at me, without wearing their badges and their name tags, that they could do that is just, it is easier for me to imagine we just move the entire country and live on the moon. It is just impossible to imagine that that would stand. And the idea that nobody seems to, and this is what is just shocking to me, the idea that even that Holder, I mean, who is theoretically the chief, not theoretically, he is the chief law enforcement officer in the country, is not saying this practice must stop right now, is they need to identify themselves as police officers, and it's not enough to be wearing body armor to do so, it seems
right.
to me.
I mean, I think you're absolutely right, Doc. I mean, it's mind-blowing. And if people can't acknowledge that point or concede that point, they're being disingenuous.
On some level, I'm just speaking to the sort of the complete lack of leadership here. I mean, how does the federal government not be more proactive, at least rhetorically? I mean, really draw the lines of what has been crossed here.
They're walking on eggshells, man. And you know, I had an interesting, a testy exchange on Twitter with Goldie Taylor about this. And you know, she was making the claim that we were demanding too much of Obama, and did we, in terms of responding to the situation, in terms of the criticisms of the second press conference, and that did we make the same kinds of demands with regard to Sean Bell and James Byrd and Abner Louima and the like. And of course, I believe that there were demands, but these situations aren't analogous, right? 9 days of civil unrest didn't follow in some ways. In the same way, right? But the point is, and I remember asking this question, saying, why is it unreasonable for black people to expect more from Obama? Why is that considered unreasonable? And why is it the case that Obama can't speak directly, right, to what is happening in Ferguson? Michael Bell came on the heels of Eric Garner. Ezell Ford was murdered in L.A., right? The young man in an open and carry state in Walmart was shot down, all within the matter of 1 month. And we have no mention of the nature of policing, right? No mention of the nature of policing vis-a-vis this particular community directly, right? And at that point, you know, you just kind of say, okay, this is not only a double standard, this is where we are. This is what America is. You know, it's like what my great-grandmother used to say to me, when people show you who they are, believe them.
Right. I mean, I saw an interview I don't know if it was Don Lemon or Jake Tapper, or somebody on CNN, was interviewing a woman who had claimed that she had a run-in with Wilson a month prior to Michael Brown being shot.
Where, I saw that interview, yep. Mm-hmm.
Where I guess she was pepper sprayed, and he refused. He didn't. She was not charged. She was not arrested. Nothing happened. But he just refused to allow anyone around her to pour milk in her eyes. Mm-hmm. And there was confusion by whoever it was that was interviewing. Like, oh, did this happen during these protests? And she's like, no, this happened a month ago. And right. That, to me, is also the story that's not being told. For every black man who is being killed by police, an unarmed black man who's being killed by police, how many, literally hundreds, if not thousands, and, you know, when we look at Stop and Frisk in New York City, I mean, how many thousands or tens of thousands of times are black people being subjected to just some form of police abuse and what that does to just your perception being in society, knowing that the one group that is literally specifically supposed to protect and serve you is doing exactly the opposite.
Right. I mean, just look at Ferguson as a case study. I mean, in 2003, there were 24,532 arrest warrants issued to black people.
I mean,
that's three per household. 86% of the stops by cops in the town of black folk. Right. When we begin to drill down in the data, you're talking about a community that's over-policed, a community that's constantly under surveillance. Right. And so, I mean, even with the Eric Garner case, I mean, when we look at the video footage, what do we see? Officer, every time I see you, you're harassing me about selling cigarettes.
Right.
And it's like, every time I see you, you're harassing me. I'm just not going to – and it's like, as if he was saying, I just can't take it anymore. Leave me alone. Leave me alone. I'm not selling cigarettes. This is what he's saying. And the next thing you know, he's in a chokehold that kills him. Right? And so there's a sense in which we're – as a nation, we're comfortable with a certain form of policing, right, that infringes upon the liberties of a particular segment of the population, right? You know, elsewhere in the country, people have – the notion of liberty has supplanted the idea of justice. People are more committed to liberty than they are to justice. But in this instance, they're not. They're saying – it's okay to police in this way. It's okay to presume guilt as opposed to innocence vis-a-vis certain people with certain bodies who live in certain communities, right? It's okay to infringe upon their freedom. And it's happening day in and day out. And then on top of that, I'm sorry, I'm getting kind of emotional about it. On top of that, can you imagine a police officer – I grew up in a household in which I was told how to behave with the police. For my life, it was a life lesson, right? Because you get killed. This is what my dad told me. And could you imagine, as you try to engage respectfully with a police officer, that the way in which he or she talks to you is demeaning, is degrading, doesn't accord you dignity, is cussing at you, roughing you up, right? And then you could have not done anything. There's the threat of arrest, right? And then they'll just lock you up and just put you there and then release you. With no charge, right? So this is daily, and then people are shocked when people are just, I've had enough. Leave me alone. Why are they at risk of resisting arrest? Why don't they respect authority, right? I mean, come on, man. At some point, damn.
And at the very least, I mean, I think the reason I think we have seen such persistence by the protesters in Ferguson is because this has been one of, it seems to me, I mean, you know, I've seen suggestions that, you know, what the people of Ferguson should be doing is organizing and voting for a recall of their city officials. And this idea that people could be subjected to this type of, you know, where they are literally being stared down by a, you know, there's no other way to really describe it, but this sort of paramilitary force, and that really mm-hmm. what they've got to do is orient themselves more towards the election box. I mean, I think this opportunity for the people of Ferguson to at least have one mode of expression, and
right.
You know, it's almost like created this zone, at least, where they're having one opportunity to be heard, at least to some degree, I imagine must be somewhat cathartic. I mean, to just literally to have this opportunity. I mean, there's been some good reporting on the ground where people have had the opportunity to sort of express what's going on there. It just seems that no one hears that beyond a certain sphere, that it gets sort of mediated. And by the time we hear the president talk about it, it really comes down to just sort of let's let the process work. Well, it's quite clear the process is not working.
Exactly. And, you know, what's beautiful about it is that there are organizers on the ground, local organizers on the ground, who are mapping out a strategy. who are mapping out a plan to pursue and to address the more structural concerns that undergird this amazingly powerful moment. I should say just as an aside, I think this is Obama's Katrina, and I think Ferguson will be as important for this generation in their political sensibility as Obama's election in 2008, in terms of shifting, waking up from this sleepwalking that was induced in 2008. But I think what on the ground there are efforts. I see them. I talk with folk on a regular basis. There are efforts to really imagine a new kind of politics that's not beholden to the old black liberal consensus narrative, right? I mean, we heard about Jesse Jackson being booed. Al Sharpton has been booed, right? We see that traditional constituency out there looking towards the ballot box, saying only 12% of black folk turned out to vote in the last election. This is, you know, then they get castigated with no analysis, right, of what this alienation from the political process might suggest other than just simply black folk being lazy politically. And so I think you hit the nail right on the head. This is a form of political expression that's messy. Democracy is messy. It challenges a certain kind of commitment to law and order. But it's also challenging, right, certain set of arrangements that I think run counter to democratic life. So it has amazing political potential. And we need to think about what happened post the riots in Watts in 65, right? The kinds of policies that followed. There was a kind of increase in the quality of black life in some ways. But since then, what, black wages have been stagnant. The economic collapse, which is a Great Depression in the black community since 2008, Ferguson is happening in a particular moment in which the crisis has come to a head. In black America, in the nation, it's going to have to confront it, just plain and simple.
I want to just,
sure.
Towards the end of our last interview, we got cut off, but you were talking about this new sort of reimagining the politics, sort of a, and you quoted Reverend Barber from the Moral Mondays movement down in North mm-hmm. Carolina is talking about a third reconstruction. And I think at that time you were talking about it as an examination of the sort of destructive force of neoliberalism and capitalism to a certain degree, and mm-hmm. race being a multiplier in terms of suffering for those who are losers in the sort of neoliberal structure. And mm-hmm. Kareem Abdul-Jabbar wrote a piece in Time saying that Ferguson's not just about systemic racism, but it is about class warfare to some extent. Mm-hmm. Talk about that nexus. I don't know if you read that piece, but
yeah, I did. I did read the piece, and you know, I think you know, it's always troublesome, even with all the insight of the piece. It's always troublesome when there is this kind of insistence that one or the other has to be the
right.
principal causal driver. Of outcomes, right? Where it has to be either class or it has to be race. What we have to see in this moment is the interpenetration of both, right? Where class and race are interacting in such a way that it's producing and reproducing these sorts of outcomes that require us to be much more subtle and nuanced in our analysis. What we do know is clear that race and poverty interact in such a way that exacerbates the experience of marginalization, right? What does it mean to be black and poor in a neoliberal context? Is pretty horrifying in its particulars. And so, what we have to do, I think, Brother Sam, is really wrap our minds around the way in which neoliberalism trades in race, in producing outcomes. And what do I mean by that? That is to say, there are particular populations that are disposable populations. And neoliberalism is content with that. And whether they can kind of contain them, right, in hyper-concentrated neighborhoods of poverty where resources don't circulate, or whether they will incarcerate them and make money off of them, right, by using incarcerated labor to produce profits for private enterprise. What we see very clearly is the very way in which what was talked about in the 80s as the black underclass, right, has experienced an extraordinary descent into darkness over the last 4 to 5 to 6 years. In fact, it's been decades in the making, right, with the disappearance of manufacturing industry, with the shrinking of government, both of which were the principal avenues to black middle class life in this country. So we need to have a really in-depth analysis of the way in which capital is working, the way in which capitalism has reorganized itself, in my view. But we need to also understand that race must figure in that analysis, because white supremacy is still working even as capital is seeking profit.
Does that make sense? Yeah, and I think actually viewing it as white supremacy makes it much easier conceptually to understand how that works there. Because, I mean, ultimately, if you are the one, if you are holding the chalice of white supremacy, and you necessarily the most effective at sort of that practice will be the wealthiest white people, right? Mm-hmm. And those with the most social power. And at that point, things begin to fall into place as to who's going to be the lowest on the totem pole. Not necessarily in terms of a plan, but sort of as a function of the way neoliberalism operates. If you have that notion in mind that it is sort of a practice of white supremacy, things begin to line up. You know, white people are there to make sure that they're a buffer between poor black people and white rich people on some
right.
level.
I mean, and you know, and the thing is that, you know, we can look at how that works just simply paying attention to the figures around the white black-white wealth gap, right? The way in which inherited wealth is working in this new economy, and the way in which black folk, people of color, are figured in that calculus, right? I mean, one of the things we do know is that the principal form of wealth for black communities has been historically owning homes, and we do know one of the devastating consequences of the crisis of 2008. Was the racialized dimension of the housing crisis. And what we saw since 2008, Brother Sam, is that the gains in wealth in the 90s have just simply been wiped out in black America, just wiped away. Right? So and you have to understand that in relation to what were the principal reasons that blocked our access to wealth. And it has something to do with the fact that white supremacy has been such a crucial ideology organizing this country. And I want to say this, too. Just as I want to say that white supremacy is a practice, I also want to suggest that freedom is a practice. Freedom is not an end. You know, it's not just something you sing and march for and then you say, boom, we got it. No, freedom is a practice. It's evident in the way in which we act, and in the way in which we go about navigating the world. And so freedom is an ongoing aim and ambition, right, in the context of arrangements that in some ways seek to thwart our efforts, if that makes sense.
And, you know, I just wanted to – the
sure.
There was a stat that just jumped out at me in some of the reading I've been doing that – and I – I think it was from Brookings, but it says that for a white family, every dollar of income turns into $5 of wealth. For the typical African-American family, $1 translates into 69 cents of wealth. In other words, we're also seeing, particularly in the past 15 to 20 years, that the rate in which that mobility is working backwards for right. black people in this country. That right. if you are born in a sort of a median income and you're white, the chances of the kids out earning the parents is something like 65%. It goes the opposite direction right. if you're black.
Right.
That's that, and that's a dramatic change from the 25 years or so, or 30 years following the Civil Rights Act.
Yeah, I mean, you hit it on the head. I mean, and when you have that kind of data in front of you, and of course we could marshal all sorts of other data, right? It becomes hard to not say what we've been saying over the course of our conversation today, right? That we have to confront this fundamental claim that some people are valued more than others. Some people's lives in this country are valued more than other people's lives. Some people's children's future are cherished more than other people's children's future, right? And we have to interrogate what that means and how that does not square with our conception of ourselves as a beacon of democratic life, right? I mean, my colleagues here at Princeton they've already made the headlines by saying that, you know, the U.S. is no longer a democracy; it's an oligarchy, right? But part of my work, and I think our work, Sam, is to really understand as carefully as we can what stands in the way of achieving our country. What blocks the way? And Ferguson is a wonderful example of this. What blocks the way? Right? It's our refusal. It's the nation's refusal to accord dignity and standing to all of its citizens, to all of its people. And there are reasons why that's the case, because people can get rich off of having disposable populations in their midst. Right? But I think we have to just, I mean, the data you just laid out and the other data, and people will dismiss it. And when they dismiss it, you just kind of say, okay, how can I say that, beyond saying this is disingenuous, how can I say that I can't have the conversation that we need to have with you because you're stuck in this thing? You're just denying the reality of the matter. But it's hard.
Right. Well, Professor Eddie Gloud, Chair of the Center of African American Studies at Princeton University and author of the forthcoming, I Can't Wait, Democracy in Black, How Race Still Governs the Soul of America. Thanks so much for your time today. Genuinely appreciate it.
It's always a pleasure. You have a great one.
You too. All right, folks. We're going to take a quick break and head into the fun half, be as it may. These days, really, just a tough couple of weeks. I mean, it's just been very, very difficult and frustrating in a number of ways. Just a reminder: this program relies on your memberships to provide both the free half and the member part of the show. You can become a member at majority.fm. We can't do this without you. Also, justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY, get 10% off. If you buy crap from Amazon, buy it from our Amazon link at majorityreportkickback.com. Just go there. Click on the link, buy what you want to buy at Amazon. You won't notice any difference. You can click on the link and bookmark it for the next time that you go buy something on Amazon. Again, you won't notice any difference. We get a little kickback. We're going to take a quick break. I should also say, friend of show, although I don't know that he's actually ever been on the show, but he's been on every show. Of course, I'm talking about the great Dave Derby, who wrote and performed our exit song. We do that at the end of the member show, so most people may not even have heard of it. Pilot Light. Interesting. Well, maybe we'll play it. He's got a new album out. His band, Gramercy Arms, features... what's his face? Lloyd Cole. Joan, I can't remember her name, but she plays the violin. They were in the Dam Builders back in the day. Check it out. We'll put a link up there. It's up on majority.fm. All right, we're going to take a quick break. 646-257-3920. 646-257-3920 is the number. You can IM me at majority.fm or via the app, which you can pick up at majorityapp.com. It's a free app. Free app. Android and iOS. Do it. We'll be back in a sec.
Say it's an apple pay.